Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Born to Talk radio show. I just love doing this every week. And my guest today is Helen Sheehy, and she is the author of Just Willa. Welcome to the show, Helen.
Oh, Marcia, it's great to be here.
I'm just delighted to have you join us. And you lead a much different life than I do, and I'm really excited to share that with our listeners. So why don't we start off by having you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Actually, I'm 3 hours later than you, so that's pretty different already.
Yes, indeed.
But I grew up on sort of remote farms in Oklahoma, in northwestern Oklahoma. And so that meant I grew up on a farm surrounded by animals and surrounded by hard work and no vacations. So basically what I wanted to do was leave the farm when I was 18, which I did. I left to get an education and then ended up on the East Coast where I worked in theater and started writing biographies of theater people. So, and then of course, one thing leads to the next, and basically what I've done, Marcia, is kind of improvised a life.
Mm-hmm. That's nice. When you say, so did you get a degree in theater arts?
I did at Wichita State University in Kansas. That's where I met my husband, and then we moved to the East Coast where he was working. And then I was teaching theater. I studied theater, and at first I wanted to be an actor, but then I realized, no, I'm not really cut out to be an actor, but I love teaching, and I did that for a while, and then I studied theater and studied American drama and ended up at the Hartford Stage Company, working with a wonderful director, Mark Lamos, and working on new plays and classics. I was their dramaturg, which is basically you're sort of an in-house critic. You help new playwrights work on their plays. You do research for the historical plays. And I wrote for the Playbill and the magazine. But it's there at that theater where I really found my vocation as a biographer because I started studying biography at that time.
Interesting. Isn't it interesting how life has its travels of how we go from where we started? And if your eye, and I just love this, if your eyes are wide open, the opportunities can be endless.
Yes.
And you don't know what's in your future. None of us do. I certainly didn't know what was going to be in my future. I didn't see myself doing this. But here I am 10 years later, and I'm just still loving it every time I get on this podcast with people that have such interesting stories, because what's your story is clearly what I'm interested in.
So exactly.
It really is. So what do you want people to know about growing up rural? Because it sounds like it was a rural area that you lived when you were in Oklahoma on the farms, right?
Yeah, it was. And it wasn't as hard a life as my parents had when they grew up on farms, because, of course, it was a little bit later. But one of the things that happens on a farm, especially, I grew up on a tenant farm, Marcia, which means that we were renters. So we didn't own vast amounts of land. So basically, you're farming on shares with the owner of the farm, but there's never enough money. And so everybody has to have a side hustle. So you're raising wheat, you're also raising cattle and pigs and chickens and selling eggs. And sometimes somebody has to take a job, you know, in the town because you need extra money. So it's a life that's filled with, I think it's true even today, because if you grow up on a farm and you have animals, unless you've got a lot of money to pay somebody to come and look after your animals, you have to do that. You have to do that yourself. So that means no vacations. You are always there because somebody has to feed. I mean, before I went to school in the morning, I had to feed the pigs and feed the chickens and gather eggs and then get ready for school and eat breakfast. So you're getting up, you know, and catch the bus for that half hour ride to town. So it's a hard life. But, you know, I wouldn't trade it. I often longed for a different kind of life, to be closer to town, and I loved going to town. But I also loved the independence of that life and being surrounded by the animals.
Am I confused? Was there something Why is 4-H Club coming up in my mind? What is
Oh, I
that?
was in 4-H.
What is that? Why did I think
Because
of that?
almost everybody and every farm kid practically in Oklahoma, Kansas, I'm sure all those farm states, every kid's in 4-H. One of my 4-H projects was I won a pig. I got a pig. I won a little Duroc Jersey gilt. Her name was Red Queen. So I showed her at the 4-H, at the fair. But turns out she was barren, so we couldn't keep feeding her, so she had to be sold. And I remember being so bummed about that. But that's the other thing, Marcia. On a farm, you just have to, I would have loved to have kept that pig as a pet, but I knew I couldn't. She had to be sold because everybody has to pull their weight, including the animals.
Yes.
So if she couldn't, if we couldn't produce more pigs with her, then there she goes. She's going to
And
be broken.
you didn't mention horses. You also had horses on your
I did not personally own a horse. Before I came on the scene in my family, they did have horses, but I didn't. But there were always horses to ride. There were neighbors had horses, and my friends had horses. So I was on a horse. And in high school, we had a little small town rodeo. So I was the rodeo queen one year. And basically, all that means, it's a tiny rodeo, and you just sell tickets, and you have a horsemanship competition, that kind of thing. So I loved that. It was so fun. And I think now, I look back on that and I think, how did I do that? I rode a couple of miles at night from the rodeo arena back to the farm in the dark. And I no way
gosh.
would I do that today. I mean, sometimes I was with my boyfriend because he was on his horse. And at times there were lights, but I can't imagine it. And I didn't wear a helmet
Oh
because
my
no, nobody wore a helmet.
gosh. Back then, no.
It was just it was a different world, just a different world.
I'm sure that's true. Do you still ride horses today?
I do.
Really?
In fact, about how many years ago? About 7 or 8 years ago, maybe longer, we traveled to Utah for a vacation, and they had horses there. And so I just got a private ride with a wrangler who turned out she was from Connecticut. And I got on that horse, and I'd ridden occasionally over my life, but and I thought, why aren't I doing this now? What's wrong with me? So I started leasing a horse, and the farm I ride at now is basically 9 minutes from my house, but it's like going back into a different time because I leave the suburbs, I go out to Bethany, Connecticut, and it reminds me of Freedom, Oklahoma, where my mother grew up. They have a huge outdoor arena and a big indoor arena, and there are cattle. And we can just last week I took oh get this the horse I rode last week. I ride a couple of horses there, but this horse's name is Trigger, and he's a Palomino, and he's a quarter horse, and he's just lovely, and he loves going out in the trail instead of being inside or in an arena. And that's a lot of fun.
That's so interesting.
So yes, I love it. It's wonderful.
That's so neat. But as an adult, do you miss being connected to the animals and the land and the way it was when you were a child?
I do, but what I don't miss, and I'm glad I kind of escaped it, is that unrelenting work. It's just a lot and the responsibility for all those animals. I mean, I've had cats in my life, but I don't want to own my own horse at this point. I just don't. It's too much responsibility. I don't want to do that. And in a funny way, I think that's one of the things that my parents were trying to tell me with education. They knew what that life was like. I mean, maybe if you're a gentleman farmer, it's a lot easier, but it's tough. So what I get from being able to go to this farm is I get to smell alfalfa again. I get to be around cattle. I get to just have a horse, just to be on a horse, just to sit on them. They are amazing creatures. So I don't miss pigs that much or chickens. Oh my gosh, we had so many chickens at one time. I do not miss that.
What about roosters?
Oh God, no. No. And they would chase me. They would attack me and flog me. No.
Really?
Do not miss that. Not even close.
Isn't that interesting?
No. It's a
That's
different
very
world.
interesting. Well, let's talk about your book because
Sure.
that's we I want I think that this is really important. The book is called Just Willa, and it's a work of historical fiction, but is it fair to say it has an autobiographical underpinning?
Oh, yes, it does. It's basically it's fictionalized story. It's based on the life of my mother. And she's the daughter, my real mother was the daughter of a homesteader who helped found Freedom, Oklahoma. So he was part of that land rush and he claimed his 160 acres in northwest Oklahoma. So, yes, and it's based on, because Marsha, I didn't know anything about her background really. Because the other thing to remember if you're growing up on a farm, and maybe with people who aren't, just people who've worked really hard and don't have time to sit down for long conversations with their family members about their past. I had never really talked to her about what her growing up was like and how she met my dad and what his life was like. And basically, the people that I'm writing about, these fictionalized people, were the Okies who stayed. A lot of the Okies fled to California, where you are, to escape the Dust Bowl, to escape the drought. But the people that I'm writing about, they stayed. They stuck it out, and boy, it was hard. It was really tough, but they did it.
That's interesting. It's having never lived in those conditions, I'm trying to imagine that what that was like, what your life was like as a child, and what it was like going to school. I presume everybody that you went to school with was in similar circumstances to yours when you were in elementary school and high school, right?
Well, yes, but in terms of the period I'm writing about would have been when Willa is a child and she's going to school in the 20s and the early 30s, which is
Got
going
it.
into the Depression. That is just brutal. I mean, she went to a run, Willa goes to a one-room school taught by a teacher, so all 8th grades are taught by the same teacher. I went to a, small elementary schools, but one of the things that is similar, except there weren't many wealthy kids in Willa's family. One of the things that's similar is that when I was going to these grade schools, no one, there weren't the sort of divisions that there are now. Nobody really, your worth really depended on a couple of things. Were you a good person? Were you a good athlete? Were you a good student? Were you kind? Were you clean? Were you decent? And nobody really cared about those other things. And it was a culture where people didn't flaunt their wealth. I mean, it is verboten. You do not talk about how many acres you own if you're a landowner. The way I was raised, nobody ever mentions, well, we have 100,000 acres of ranch land. Nobody, no, you would never say that, ever. Or you would never distinguish people by, well, there's a person who's just a renter. And there's an owner. It wasn't done. It was bad form. It was tacky. It's interesting. I think maybe that's changed a little.
Maybe. So I understand that this is your first novel after three successful biographies. Two of them, congratulations, were New York Times notable books. What were they? What were
Oh,
those two
thank
for?
you. Thank you, Marcia. The first one was called The Life and Theater of Margo Jones, and Margo Jones was a Texan. And I told you that I started this biographical work when I worked at Hartford Stage Company, and I met an old stage manager there. And we used to sit back and talk while the play was going on. And he had worked with Margo Jones in Dallas, Texas, and what Margo did is she basically founded the resident theater movement in this country. So when you the theaters that you see around, like the Guthrie Theater, the Arena Stage, Long Wharf Theater in New Haven, Connecticut, that was her idea to have a really good professional theater in every city over, you know, of 100,000 or over, and it would give actors and playwrights and designers a place to work and create their art. This is going to sound funny, but it was a great book for a first-time biographer because she had a short life. Her life was like a comet. She died at 43 I'll just send this out as a tease, because she had a curious and unusual death and died at 43. And the reason I say that is because I actually was on the show, Curious and Unusual Deaths, up in Canada. It's very tragic how she died. So that was the first book. And then the second book was a biography of Eva Le Gallienne. It's a wonderful, wonderful, just sort of a... She could do anything. She was an actor. She adapted plays. She translated plays. She directed. She started a major theater company downtown in New York City, which kind of was the forerunner of Off-Broadway. And it also was sort of a nonprofit theater. She wanted it dedicated to art, not commerce. She was a huge Broadway star, but she gave it all up to start this theater downtown. And she had a huge, long career. So I loved doing that book. And then the last one, probably she's the most famous actor it's Eleonora Duse, who's really the first modern actor. She's the actress, the Italian actress, who inspired Stanislavski to create his method. She showed a woman as a human being on stage. Oh, and poor me, Marcia, I had to go research in Italy.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, terrible. I had to go to Venice and read love letters. It was heaven. But one of the reasons I turned to, so I'd written these three biographies. Each one takes 7 to 8 years. So that's a big chunk of my life. And then at the end of it, I was sort of looking around and I realized I knew so much more about these women, strangers, than I knew about my own mother,
wow,
who had died when I was 36. So she never read any of these biographies. And I thought, how can that be? So just for me, kind of as a personal project, I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to start researching it. So I think I started the year Duse was published, which was in 2003. But I didn't have any ambitions because I thought, oh, who would care about this ordinary woman from Oklahoma? After I'd written about the most famous actress in the world ever, who started a new form of acting. But then I got kind of hooked on the research, and it was so much fun to do that. You know, go back, look at the Dust Bowl, look what happened in the Depression, look at these roots in Oklahoma. And so that kind of became an obsession with me because I wanted to know who she was.
Interesting. So why change the genres at this stage in your writing career? And is it harder to write fiction? Or is it easier to write a biography?
Oh, it's so much easier to write biography. For me, it's so much easier because with biography, you have the template, you have the life there. You've got all the research, you've got letters and archives and diaries for a lot of, well, Le Gallienne kept almost a daily diary. So I have all this material and I had interviews. I had tons of material. Well, with this novel, I didn't. I mean, I had people ask me, well, why don't you just write a memoir, like a family history? But I couldn't possibly. We were poor tenant farmers. We didn't have, and there's a reason why we don't have a lot of family photographs and papers, which is revealed in the book, because I do base that on fact. So I decided, why not just try it? Why not try? But I think one of the reasons it's taken me so long, because it's difficult, because there's so many possibilities. You have to make so many choices. And you really don't have to do that in biography because the arc of the life is already there. It's there for you. And in a large sense, Willa's life is loosely based on my mother's arc, the birth, the death. But in between, so many things had to be imagined. I mean, some of the things I could base in fact, but a lot of it had to be imagined. And I tell you, that was so fun. It became, because no footnotes. I can just make things up based on it's heaven.
Did you have siblings?
I did, yes. So I was able to talk to them.
Okay, I was just curious about that, because where are you in the pecking order of your siblings?
I'm the baby. I'm the youngest. And so, yes, that really helped to be able to talk to them. And I don't know if you have siblings, but everybody remembers everything differently.
Absolutely.
Nobody has the same memory of any event. It's so funny. So I also found wonderful material in old newspapers, the Freedom Call, the Alva Courier, because old newspapers, there are so many novels in these. I read decades of old newspapers. There are so many novels in these old newspapers because newspaper writing used to be a lot more detailed than it is now, maybe because of privacy laws, but oh my goodness, I couldn't believe the things that are in the newspaper that I uncovered. And some of the things in the Freedom Call, I discovered about my own family, because my grandmother, my mother's mother, actually wrote a column for the Freedom Call.
No kidding.
And the column would be about, sometimes she'd talk about current events, sometimes she'd talk about who was over to Sunday dinner, and just musings, and sometimes she'd throw in a poem, and because she was a writer, and loved to read. So, but it became invaluable. Plus, I met a newspaper reporter in Alva, Oklahoma, who actually knew my family and had known my father, who started his life as a cowboy and a bootlegger and a boxer. So he remembered, and he had some stories that were just, oh boy, I wish I could have talked to my dad about some of those. But
oh, I bet.
You know?
Well, I know your book is a historical fiction, and there must have been a lot of serious amount of research that was involved. And perhaps you can just kind of take us through, what was it like to just start writing and see, you know, what was it like? Do you outline? Do you just start writing? No. What's your process like?
Okay. My process, I started using sort of the same process I do with biography. And the most important thing with me with biography, and I think with a novel too, especially if you're going to set it in a historical place. So my novel is set primarily in northwestern Oklahoma and southwestern Kansas. So I needed to go back and walk the ground. So that was the very first thing I did. I traveled back to Freedom, Oklahoma. I went back to the original home place, which, by the way, is still in the family. My cousin Kai runs an Angus breeding operation there. And so he's expanded that original 160 acres, but it's still there. And honestly, I don't think the landscape has changed that much, because there's not a lot of built up around there. It's pretty, I don't know, you've probably seen the cover of the book, and the cover of the book is basically just the open prairie, and that's on the old homestead. And as you can see, there are no trees there at all, because my grandfather was smart, and he decided he wanted that high prairie. And you don't have to uproot trees if you're going to plant wheat and oats and the things you need to plant. So it's just one less task for you to do. So then you can look sort of 5 miles down across to the Cimarron Valley, and there's the Cimarron River down below there. So I just walked around there and sort of soaked it up, the smells, the sounds, the cattle, talked to relatives, tried to find old photographs that I didn't have that some of my relatives had. So I sort of absorb all that and then research for a couple of years, and then I just start writing. And no, I do not have an outline. I was trained in the theater, and one of the ways I was trained, and I love teaching improvisation. Mm-hmm. And you just imagine, you just what if. You maybe start with an image. And the first chapter of the book, I just had an image of, because we always had a burn barrel on our farm.
I don't know what that is.
A burn barrel. So if you live on a farm, there's nobody who's going to come around and pick up your trash.
I guess
You
not.
just don't have it. So if you have any trash and if it can be burned, you would take it to the burn barrel and you would burn it. If you have any compostable stuff, you would compost that, you know, for the garden. But anything burned, you'd put in the burn barrel. So we always had a burn barrel, and it was out, you know, somewhere away from the barn, away from any buildings. And I just had an image of Willa burning things in a barrel. And then I kind of took it from there. And then one thing leads to another. And I just, I mean, I know where I'll end up because it's the arc of her life. But I'm not sure, because there's so many choices. There's so many stories.
Right.
There are too many stories. So you have to select which stories.
And so as these ideas come to your mind, do you have a notebook near somebody where you just will just take a pen and just write a note to yourself, like, remember
this? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I have so many little scraps of paper.
Oh, I bet you do.
And that's what I did when I'd go on these trips. I would just get an idea, or I just had lists of things, just scenes, because I tend to write in scenes and people coming together, coming apart, you know, imagine their dialogue. I'd always imagined, because I didn't know how Willa and Jake would meet, but I always imagined that they would meet at a dance. So that was fun.
Well, let's,
and I
talk
had,
about, let's talk about, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let's,
no,
just talk,
that's fine.
About, let's talk about the protagonist, Willa Hardestay.
Sure.
She was the daughter of a homesteader, and she goes on to become the wife of a tenant farmer. So I think you might have already explained that. What's the difference between those two things, between the homesteader and the tenant farmer?
Okay, well, the homesteader could, if you came in and you could claim 160 acres of land, and if you improved that land, then you would get the title to it. So that meant you were a landowner. So I always felt, and I always felt this about my own mother, I always felt like she had a sense of herself as being one of the original people of freedom. There was a pride there that she was the daughter of a homesteader. But she marries for the second time. Jake is her second husband. She marries a man who, well, he earned his living basically by cowboying for other people and making change on the side as a bootlegger and as a boxer. At the beginning, he was a boxer. So they rented a farm. So by renting, that means you rent a tenant farm. So 2/3 of the money you get, 2/3 of the, and 1/3 of the crop. It's usually 2/3, 1/3 share. And there's a home there. There's usually a building that you have, you know, there's a place you can stay. And they just operate like that. So they're not owning the land, but they're working the land. They're building a life on the land. Often they will stay there for years. Sometimes they'll be forced to leave. So it's a more precarious existence than if you're a landowner. But even if you're a landowner, you might have a mortgage on that place that you're going to have to meet, you know, at each harvest.
So what role did both of them play in America's history?
Well, I think it's more about the economic history.
Okay.
Because one of the things that you can give to your family is you can pass down a legacy. And I've thought about this a lot, about what kind of a legacy, because I have friends here who are from old New England families who've had legacies of all kinds of possessions and trust funds and money. Mm-hmm. But if you come out, I mean, another way, the South, people in the South call this being a sharecropper. I call it tenant farm because that was kind of what it was when I was growing up. But it's hard to pass down any money, any real economic, anything like that. So, but in a funny way, I think the legacy I got was this ambition that my mother had, and my father too, but mostly my mother. And this is true for Willa in the book. Their legacy was get educated. Do something, you know, find something else to do with your life. You can have a better life than we had. This is why we're working so hard, so you can have a better life. But there's also something moral that I think they pass down, because you can have a financial legacy that's passed down, but you can also have a moral bankruptcy. And that, I think, is worse. I think the legacy I got from my family and the legacy that Willa gives her family is a kind of incredible moral legacy. And it's very simple, really. It's just, you know, working hard, paying attention, being kind, all of those things that are so important. And the other one, oh man, was this drilled into me, never lie. That was just the worst possible sin. If you were lazy and you were a liar, oh my gosh, it was just, that was the worst. So it wasn't a lot that was passed down, but that kind of moral legacy, I think, was very, very important.
I think, do you have children?
I do not.
Okay. My children also do not have children, but I would say that, but my husband and I also raised them with, as you just described, a moral legacy about being honest and
yes,
living a life that you could look in the mirror and say, I'm proud of you.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
If you look in the mirror and you go, oh God, I can't believe you did that. You
exactly.
know, that's not great. And Art, listen, I mean, like I say, I have two children. They do watch me. They do pay attention to what I do.
Yes.
And I know that to be true. And I think that it's very interesting. And I'm wondering back to your book, because I just think it's so interesting. What became of the homestead you described in your book?
Well, this is such an arc, because the first 160 acres, well, it's still in the family. My mother's brother, her youngest brother, bought out the sisters, and he eventually, so his great-grandson, or actually it's just his grandson owns the property, has expanded it into a big Angus breeding ranch. And what he does, get this, Marcia, I went to his online bull auction for his Anguses. He sold five bulls for $25,000 each.
Oh my gosh, who buys a bull for $25,000?
Okay, you know who buys a bull for that much?
No.
A commercial breeder. A commercial breeder who wants to improve his herd. And that commercial breeder will then sell his herd. So that's going to become the very expensive steak that you're eating, you know, you're paying lots of money for in a, you know, of a grass-fed beef. So I've talked to Kai a lot about what's happened with the land, because when my granddad, he was farming wheat and oats and feed and, you know, different things and had a garden. But now Kai mostly plants, if he has any, he plants wheat, but he plants wheat for the cattle to graze on. And he mixes crabgrass with the wheat. So when the wheat dies, the wheat pasture dies, the crabgrass goes. So the cattle eat the crabgrass. And in a dry county, in a dry area, this is perfect feed. So these are all really great grass-fed beef. So he's basically breeding these prime cattle, and he breeds them now. Because I asked him, I said, so what are you breeding for? And what they breed for are vigor. Because imagine these cattle, especially first-time mamas, the heifers, are giving birth. They're out in the pasture. They're out in the wheat pasture. So they basically are having a calf. That calf is on its feet within 20 minutes and nursing.
Wow.
And they're doing it all on their own. I mean, it's not like it used to be, you know, where sometimes the cows would get in trouble, but he's got an amazing operation. But here's the thing. What's going to happen eventually to that land? It's become too valuable, because his son just bought 900 more acres. He could turn around right now and double his money. And this astonished me, because I said, wait, who's going to spend that much money for this land in the middle of nowhere. It's not even close to any large towns. There's no hotels. And it astonished me. Hunters from, the South, from Florida, from Georgia, they want the prime big bucks to hunt. And that's who lives on this land. And they want to be close to the river valley and maybe build a lodge there. And they'll hunt on it maybe two or three times a year. So what's going to happen to all that land is it's just going to go back to the way it was before Granddad homesteaded it. Well, Isn't that wild?
Yeah, it is. It's very wild when you're speaking to somebody that's a city girl. And I'm
you're a city girl. Los Angeles, yes.
Huh. I can't even fathom what this is like. I've gone to the East Coast. I have experienced some open spaces, but nothing like what you've just described.
And I
would imagine there are listeners that might be in the same situation I'm in that would say, well, me either, as a matter of fact. And I mean, I'm thinking about, we'll have like a county fair and people will go to the county fair and you'll see pigs and you'll see cows and you'll see people milking the cows and things like that. You'll see bulls. But that is... You even have to travel maybe more than an hour to even go to where that county fair is even located.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Because it's just not in the reality of a city person. If you've grown up in the city, you really don't have, the closest I got to a horse was a merry-go-round. I'm just telling you, there were no horses around here.
Oh, and, exactly. Yeah. It's so different, but what's happened is that Freedom, Oklahoma, where the book is set, used to be kind of a bustling town. It was small, but it was bustling, and now it's not. And the school is, they still have a school because they're too far from other towns to be, so many of these schools are consolidating, and it's too far away from other schools, so there are some grades that only have two kids.
Really?
It's really tough. And there are not many places to work. I mean, in one way, it's changing. And I don't think there's anything that's going to change it back. Because if land is going to become so valuable to just a few people who want to use it basically as a private hunting preserve, it will go back to the way it was. And then Kai has kind of a black sense of humor. And he says, well, then it'll probably just all burn again. Which it would. Yeah. It would. It would all burn. It would eventually. And then, of course, it would grow again. But
I'm just thinking about in today's world with electronics, with the internet, with all of the things that most of us all take for granted. And I'm thinking about, how do you live out in the country where... How do you even get your electricity supplied to you?
Oh, they have no. That's definitely there. They all have that. Everybody has Wi-Fi.
Okay.
For example, when Kai did his auction, he has an annual bull auction every year. People bid at his auction, mostly from the United States, but he does sell bulls to Canada, sometimes into Europe, but mostly it's the United States. Everybody's online. They're all looking at it. Used to be you'd go to an auction, you'd actually go there. I mean, the bulls are actually there on his ranch, so you can go see them. But there are also videos of them all moving, so you could actually, be thousands of miles away and bid on that bull and online. So they're very savvy. The people out there who are still making a living, they're incredibly savvy about how to do this, how to make it work, how to get the most out of the land. But it's a tough life. I mean, his wife has another job. She's head of all the ambulances in Woodward, Oklahoma, which is probably almost, I think it'd be half an hour away from their ranch.
Wow.
So it's a tough life, but
I would guess so. And in your back to your book, because I do want people to understand more about your book, one of your characters in your book is a bootlegging cowboy, and I thought maybe you could tell us about the role that bootlegging played during the Great Depression.
Well, one of the things it did was a way for people to make money, because of course, you know, it was illegal to sell liquor, but of course everybody was still buying liquor. So the character in my book is Jake. He has kind of a deal with a very prominent man who's a businessman and a politician, and he's one of the big kind of liquor smugglers that Jake helps out from time to time. But then to get even more money, what Jake does is he sells pint bottles of booze at dances, because everybody wants to drink while you're at the dance. And by the way, bootlegging, you could just slip that little bottle inside your boot.
Really?
So he sells bottles. You know, he'd fill his car trunk up full of these pint bottles of booze and sell it at dances. And then after the dance, one of the things he would do is he would, because everybody's just tossing these pint bottles out, he'd go collect all the pint bottles, clean them out, start all over again. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it certainly helped during the Depression, when the wage for some people was like $1 a day. It's not much. One of my characters is a boxer, and he's a pretty good one, and he can make maybe $20 a night if he's boxing, which is a huge amount of money for a young man during the Great Depression.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. So what fueled Willa's determination to educate her children?
I think it probably stemmed from the fact that Willa was denied an education. She wanted to go, she was very, very intelligent. She wanted to go past the eighth grade. Her teacher knew that she was incredibly intelligent and wanted her to go to high school, but that would have cost money. It was a high school in town, and she was needed on the farm, and her father really didn't believe in higher, you know, going on for women and going to high school. You know, she's going to get married anyway. So I think that always, it was sort of bitter that she knew that she could have done better, that she really, really wanted to do that. So there was this big push for her kids to do that, for her, especially her daughters, that she really wanted them to, and for her sons too, but she really wanted them to have this. So I think it was a way that she could see a better life for them, mm-hmm. you know, a life that she didn't have. And I don't think it's because she hated her life or any of that. I think it was just a life that offered more possibility, more opportunity, because it's never good to see something cut off like that. And for her, it was. Her life was just stopped. Something that she really wanted, she was denied. And so that possibility was ended for her.
She was very much a forward thinker, wasn't she?
Oh, she was. Oh, my goodness. So smart, really. And you know, her dad was, too. Her father. And she was very close to her father, Willa was. And he was very innovative about farming and getting through the Depression and learning how to terrace his land. Remember I said these are the Okies who stayed? Well, they stayed because they got smart about their farming practices. They, you know, so all the land's just not going to blow away. But he did that because he read things. He listened to the agricultural. You know, he read the columns by the agricultural consultant in the Freedom Call. Except he really cared more about getting electricity in his barn than he did in his house. And it took him a long time before he got a flush toilet in their house. I think that probably was in the 40s.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So your book is called Just Willa. And Willa is spelled W-I-L-L-A for those of you that are listening. And you'll see that when you read about this on podcasts. But I'm just wondering, what's the significance of the word just in the title of your book?
Well, when I first started researching, I just kept thinking, who really, I mean, she's just an ordinary woman from nowhere, and who would even care? And then I gave a talk here in New Haven, and they wanted me to talk about my three biographies, the New York Times Notable Books, But then they asked me to talk about what I was working on. And so I thought, okay, I'll tell them about these characters I'm working on, Jake and Willa. And so I talked to them about Jake and Willa and the Dust Bowl and farming and ranching and the Depression and boxing and bootlegging. Marcia, they were riveted.
Really?
They did not ask me one question about the three biographies. They wanted to know about these people. And I left that talk and I thought, oh my gosh, maybe they would care. So part of the title is Just Willa. You know, she's just Willa. She's nobody special. But the other part of it is Just Willa. She's the center.
Right.
So anyway, and you just always question your assumptions.
Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing that as long as you're not hard on yourself. You know,
yes.
Sometimes we have to question why we do the things that we do.
Yes, many times.
We wonder. I know. I mean, I live alone. I question a lot of the things that I do, and I wonder, gee, what could I have done differently about that?
Right.
I wonder how that could have been different. And, you know, sometimes you, it's funny. I have post-it notes all over my office area, and just is actually. One of those things, it's just, sometimes I just have to look at the self and just say, just take your time.
Yes, yes.
Just finish what you started.
Exactly.
You know, there are so many notes to remind me to just be kind. Mm-hmm. We talked about kindness earlier.
Mm-hmm.
If we know how to be kind to others,
right,
we certainly need to know how to be kind to ourselves.
Well, and I thought about this as I was writing it, or after I finished it, because I've spent a lot of time in my life beating myself up about how clueless I was when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized after writing this that a huge character in this book is time. And time is so important. It changes you. You are different. Time, the passage of time, what that means and how you relate to it, it's just, it's so important. And your attitude is so different as you age. I'm much kinder to myself now than I used to be. And I'm more empathetic than I used to be because mm-hmm. I realize this.
Well, I think that words really matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do believe that words matter. Obviously, as an author and someone that taught drama and did all of that, words obviously mean a lot to you as well.
Mm-hmm.
How we use our words,
yes.
And what we want to convey with others about what that might be. I tell people all the time, I mean, I didn't expect to be doing this, as I mentioned earlier, but it is what it is what my husband would say. And I think that words really matter. And honestly, maybe you can relate to this, I don't know, but honestly, I've never met a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that we as humans have something we can share with one another. We may not have the same background. We may not have the same lifestyle, but we do share the fact that we are all humans.
That's so
and
true.
What bothers me, because I live in a city, I don't live in a rural setting, and what bothers me, and I notice this more and more recently because I do a lot of walking, is when you are walking and approaching somebody, can you not at least just nod and bow your head at
yes.
that person?
Yes.
Why do you pretend like you don't even see that person and you're looking right at them? I find that to be, honestly, I find it to be rude.
It is rude. Oh, no. Yes.
I agree with that.
I totally agree with that. I mean, that's the way I was brought up. And so many cultures are like that. I don't know if you've ever been to Paris, but one of the things you do when you go in is you say hello. Bonjour. You say hello. And you thank them. And you do that in Italy. You do that in so many cultures. You do it in Oklahoma. That's how I was raised, that you do that. You greet people. You look someone in the eye. You shake their hand if you're meeting them. It's just, that's just being a decent person. And Marcia, what is it that we share? 99.9% of our genes, we're all related. So whether or not I have children, I am related to everybody on this planet that's a human being, no matter where you live.
It's very interesting. I've done a lot of traveling. I've been up and down the whole country of Vietnam. I've also been to South Africa. And what I notice in both of those places is that when you approach somebody, that whether you are driving a Mercedes or you are living in a container and you have nothing, when you approach somebody and you see somebody, you at least nod your head.
Yes.
And I wish that we as a culture here were better at doing that. I really wish that that was something that we all did better. Maybe we share the same opinion.
I think if you took a road trip across Oklahoma or Kansas, almost, and if they were native there, everybody would wave at you or just, you know, tip their hat or a few fingers as they pass you. That's just how it's done. It's
right. That's just
so I kind of still do that. I think we all have to keep doing that.
I do too. I'm not going to stop doing that. You know, I personally am not going to stop doing that. But I just have to accept that not everybody thinks the same way. And your book, what message does your book convey about the fragility of how fragile our life is?
Well, I think, especially growing up on a farm, you realize that you're so close to life and death because something's always dying on a farm. But on the other hand, something's always being born on a farm. I remember seeing my father literally pull a calf from a cow. The calf was stuck and I saw it born. But I've seen him shoot a hog that was sick that he had to put down. And in my novel, Willa has just the most devastating loss that you can imagine. It just brings her to her knees. And for me, it's finding a way to live with loss. Every human has to deal with that. And I know that you've had to deal with that. It's something that we all share. It's our challenge as just being human beings to try to live with that loss. But I chose an epigraph for my book by W.H. Auden. And the epigraph says, art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead.
Whoa.
And what that means is that this is a fictional book. I cannot bring my mother back to life, but I can create a character named Willa and try to make her live on the page. And I just realized Willa bakes bread. She does. She bakes bread. So I think aren't all writers doing that, though? Aren't we just trying to create something that's living on the page, something that people can relate to on a human level?
I believe that's true. And there was a time when there weren't things called book clubs. And now they're so very, very popular. And I think that when people get together with their book clubs, and they've all read their same book, and then they go through that discussion of what these different chapters might have meant to them, because we've all lived a different lifestyle.
Oh, they're all so different. I've had friends who read this book, and they're all responding to different things. There's a character who suffers from schizophrenia.
Okay.
And a friend has a daughter who had a serious episode, and she's fine now. But that just resonated with her. I had a reader from Brooklyn who has never been on a farm in his life, but he connected with it because of the way he was raised. And there's a part of this that, Marsha, I read this and it's like, it's another world. It's the 20th century, but for me, it seems it's gone now. It's just gone. And we're in a different time now, but I really think it's important to remember what those times were like and who those people were and get them on the page and try to make them live.
Absolutely. Do you write every day?
I do not.
Okay.
Especially right now, I'm not, because I'm mulling over another novel. Everything I write is totally different from the other thing I've written. So I'm really wrestling with the structure of a novel that I'm working on right now. And it doesn't work right now. Like I said, it's really hard to write fiction. I wrote a short story. I've only written two short stories in my life, two, both published. One was just selected for Best Small Fictions of 2024. That short story took me 30 years to get the ending right.
Oh my goodness.
I had worked on that story and I never sent it out because I thought it doesn't work. But it had to be, I couldn't figure out the ending until I reached a certain age and knew what that story meant. Because for me, when I write not because I have to sit down and just grind something out every day. I write to figure stuff out. So writing Just Willa was figuring out the mystery of who was my mother, who are Will and Jake, what was this world like? So I have to discover it. So I don't know where I'm going until I get there. And I don't know how long it's going to take me.
Right.
So, you know,
there's
what?
There's a lot of what ifs. There's a lot of what ifs in our lives, isn't there?
Yes. Yes.
What if?
What if? And you know what? That's so funny because I teach improvisation and I had the best experience for 2 years teaching improvisational theater and theater to the TRU unit at a maximum security prison here in Connecticut.
Wow.
And it was so wonderful because in this prison, and I told them when we started, I said, look, this, we're going to create a theater here. It's our sacred place. We can make this anywhere because we weren't allowed props. Of course you can't have props. No props, no costumes. So this is totally poor theater. But if you have that, well, then you can imagine any place. We could be on Mars. We could be underwater. We could be in a cab in New York City. You can be any place where your imagination takes you. It was thrilling. And that's why that's why I love writing and making stuff up so much, because there's so many possibilities.
There are. And you get to be the driver of that ship.
Yes.
That car,
yes.
Or that, yes. Or the person on that horse. You are that person.
And when you get to a certain point, when the character is kind of there and you see them and they're moving around, then they have their own ideas of what they're doing. And that's really fun because that's what happens in improv if you're creating a character. So basically how I write is just I'm putting myself in the heads of all these characters and imagining what they would do in that situation, because you're always asking, you know, what do you want? What do you love? What do you care about? What are you willing to do to get what you want?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, for me, it's just so much fun to do. So I've never felt like it was sort of drudgery to do it. I looked forward to getting back into the story. In fact, I miss it now. I miss working on it.
I can feel the passion that you have in this.
Yeah.
And this has been such a great time to be able to discuss this, because we really all could utilize something positive, and this is clearly very positive. And you've just shared what's so positive about you with our listeners. And I'm just very grateful for having you join me today.
Oh, Marsha, thank you so much. I've loved our conversation. It's so great. Lovely. I don't get many, you know, it's nice to be able to talk about these things and
absolutely
think about them.
Because you have a passion and it's
mm-hmm
clear.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for joining me. I look forward to sharing this podcast to all the people that can listen to this. And we'll just wait to see what's next for you, my friend. I'm sure there's something coming next.
No, there may be. We'll see. We'll see if I can figure out the structure. All right. Thanks again, Marcia. Really fun.
Have a great rest of your day.
Okay,
bye
you too.
Bye for now, everybody.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.